Make a note of the records you just played then.
I can remember that. I've got them in order.
Wow, that was so good. I've got Gerald. Gerald is here. I don't really want to share Gerald with you.
Tough luck. I'm not going anywhere.
No, because it's almost like I'm giving away my one of my key sources for music. I know that you've been... Apart from doing absolutely tremendous record label over the years. You've also been, you know, you deal still, you still deal in old music, right?
Kind of, yeah. It's kind of taken a back seat, really, because, you know, there's not enough hours in the day to do reissuing the old stuff and selling the old stuff too. And there's so many sources now, I think, just, you know, individuals selling records. You know, I can let some other people into the game too, you know.
Is that how you started? Was it like, how did you start? Because you're from Middlesbrough, right?
Yeah.
And
there's no records up there.
A hotbed of scene. Was it? I mean, was it? Were you a clubber before you got into music? What was the sort of your intro? Because I mean, basically, for when I'm getting stuff, when I go to your store, or not, it's not a store. When I go to see you, I can be assured that you're going to have amazing modal jazz and spiritual jazz, but also you've got some amazing funk and soul and sort of that kind of rare groovy area. Was it more that you came through on? Did you get to the jazz?
They were side by side. This was in the 80s when I was getting into music, and I think literally the jazz scene was, and the jazz dance scene was starting at the end of the 80s, just as the rare groove scene was appearing at the same time, with Norman Jay and Shaking Finger Pop and all the rest of it. And I saw them both as much of the same thing, black American music from, you know, the olden days. And I wasn't really aware that they were two completely separate scenes. And they kind of mixed together a little bit, but I just liked it all. And, you know, even now, I don't really try and categorise that much. There's a wide variety of music I like, not just the jazz side and the soul and funk side. There's all kinds of stuff that I like as well, mostly from the past. I just haven't, but the trouble is there's just not enough time to get into everything. I actually remember making a conscious decision when I was about 18 or 19. I just can't get into everything, you know, everything from reggae to psych to jazz. You can't do everything. And I specifically made a conscious decision to go down the route of finding out and learning about the jazz side of things and the funk side of things, and still doing it 20 years on. There's so much record, so many records out there, so much music out there.
That's what you were saying earlier on, because I was looking at a Freddie Roach record, and it's the one with Voices, Things Come Good or something. What's it called?
Oh, the choral one, yeah. Yeah. All That's Good.
All That's Good. I was looking at that album and saying there's a really good track on it, Cloud 788, and then you said that our ears have changed, because when this would have come up a few years ago, you'd have gone organs with choirs.
That's right. Your taste does change. You can listen to a record, say, 20 years ago, and you like one particular track and you think it's brilliant. You listen to the same thing now and you think that track's brilliant, and a different track is really good, and you think, how the hell did I miss that all those years ago? And your ear does develop over time as it gets used to listening to things, and your mind either contracts or it expands, and you listen to different stuff in a different way. And so even records that you've had a long time, you can listen to with a completely different attitude and enjoy different songs in it that you might have done in the past. And the opposite is true as well. Stuff you may have loved, you think it's a load of rubbish now. You think, what the hell am I doing with that?
Well, sometimes records sound really good one day, and then you play them again to your friends a few days later, and they sound crap.
That's right. They can point things out to you that you missed, and you know, your state of mind changes.
Yeah.
So yes, that's another beauty of them. You know, even the same thing can sound different.
Yeah. The record label's been going for how long now?
Since 1998.
1998. Okay. And because when you had your warehouse in Camden, that was the very beginnings of the record label, was it?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we were just doing secondhand records then, and it got to a point in the late 90s when the records really started to become harder to find in America, and they started to become more expensive. And it was the start of the internet revolution, where people could sell things online. And it just basically dawned on me that, you know, these records, they're not getting easier to find. More and more people want them. Something, you know, it's a crying shame that a lot of these records are only going to be heard by the collectors who are rich enough to afford to buy them, or dedicated enough to seek them out. There's got to be a way, you know, a wider audience that would appreciate this music, because, you know, this music's just phenomenal. It just deserves to have wider recognition. And the major record labels, they weren't really doing too much, you know, they weren't really doing much digging, so to speak, and it was very risky for them to put resources into doing that. So so I had that record by Kathleen Emery, which I don't think anyone else really had at the time. And I thought, this is just daft, just me having this. And I didn't really want to bootleg it or anything, so that on a white label. So we pressed up 500 copies, and they flew out. And that was the start, I thought. And the only reason we did it on 7 as well, I thought, was because it was cheap. I didn't want to spend loads of money doing an album or a CD. And I couldn't believe it that, you know, they all sold so fast. So I thought, let's do another one. We just moved on, and here we are. I think it's 70 singles odd now that we've done in that time. Plus, obviously, we moved on to albums and CDs too. And it's, you know, it's all about getting the rarities out there, the stuff that should be heard by people.
Okay, let's go with some music. Terrific album, which came out on Jazzman. Was it last year, the spiritual jazz one?
Yeah, it was last summer. Yeah, we did this, I think.
Great sleeve, brilliant track listing, nothing too obvious on there. This is where I discovered Moore Tyam as well, who is the father of
Akon.
That's right, deep one. And we played Ayo and then you're actually going to be putting out the album as well.
Well, I've been in contact with his manager for quite a while. He's hard to get hold of because he's between America and Senegal a lot, and it's one of those tread carefully things. So sooner or later we'll have a meeting and sort it out. And it's the thing is with reissuing a lot of these records, it takes ages and ages to get the deal sorted and finalised, because, you know, they have to be aware of what exactly you're trying to achieve, and then there's money side of things, and it's difficult sometimes. It's not a straightforward, easy to negotiate deal where you just click your fingers and it's all done. And that's why some of these things are just ages and ages to work out, especially with them being most of the people out of the country. It's hard work. And especially when they're hard to contact like that. But we'll get it sorted sooner or later, I hope.
I mean, you must have so many stories of meeting these people that we've revered as collectors, and then you meet these guys like Ricardo Moreira or James Spalding and Nathan Davis.
Yeah.
And they've always got a good story, haven't they? Interesting lives.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it comes out in the music. I mean, the very fact that a lot of the records that we put out have been privately pressed just goes to show a lot about the personalities behind the people that made the records. A lot of them just didn't care to be widely recognised or to have a major label record deal. They were happy doing their own thing. And some of them were quite the opposite. They really, really wanted to get, you know, be famous or whatever have you, or become really successful. So they put their own record out in the hope that they get some recognition. And, it, you know, it failed for whatever reason. So, but all of them got one thing in common, and that is, you know, they were determined to actually get their music out there, heard, even without the backing of a major label. So, you know, they put their money on the line and put everything they had into making these privately pressed independent records. Nathan Davis is no exception. You know, he was offered, and James Spaulding for that matter, you know, they were both offered deals by Blue Note, but turned it down because they didn't want to compromise their artistic integrity, and they wanted to make their own music how they wanted to make it, release it how they wanted it to be done. And that's why they're not household names. Otherwise, they could well have been, you know, like a lot of the other guys on Blue Note. And the same goes for a lot of the musicians on the Spiritual Jazz album as well. They, a lot of them were privately pressed, self-released records, and they did it because they had the inner urge, and that's what they believed, and that's what they wanted to do. And they couldn't convince a major label to do it, or didn't have the wherewithal to be able to facilitate that. And, you know, like it is with anyone today, it's hard to get a proper record deal. So they just did it themselves, distributed it locally, sold it out the back of the car. But at least, you know, they recorded, you know, they created that art, and they actually got it out there, and even if it wasn't small numbers. But it doesn't mean to say it's no good, just because it's, you know, it wasn't successful. Yeah. Far from it.
Some of that music's amazing. I mean, you started off this little thing that we're doing here with 4 7-inches in a row. Kicked off with a track by Michel Manier, which is a 7-inch that I once owned.
But you lost it.
I lost it. It's one of those records that maybe I'll find it when I clear this place out at one stage. Maybe it sort of fell through the floorboards. I think there's some music underneath the floorboards upstairs, actually. But it's a little 7-inch, but it's really nice to see that again. Michel Manier, Le Monocle, Riz Jaune, from the film. Some great films. Georges Lutney. That's great. I might just hide it. and then it was the James Spaulding terrific sleeve. Do you kind of, going through 7-inches, it takes an extra amount of patience and fingernail?
Yeah, you could say that again, because there's so many of them, there's millions of them, and not all of them are good, obviously. A lot of them are rubbish, and there's so many millions and millions of sevens. For every album, there's 1,000 sevens, and it's hard work looking through them. I mean, to be honest, I'm not the world's greatest digger. I often let other people do that work, and I'll just pay them the money for the record that they find. But it's so time-consuming, and you know, I've got a lot of respect for people who dig through 1,000 sevens, or sorry, 1,000, that's not really very many, 100,000 sevens, say, and pull out the two or three beauties in there. Because it's hard work, and it's really draining listening to millions and millions of sevens, one after the other, trying to find something good.
When a record that looks as good as James Spaulding, with a title like Uhuru Sasa and a label called East with Red, Black and Green label.
Yeah, it doesn't get much better.
You're going to spot that, aren't you?
Yeah, that's true. It's a bit of a no-brainer, that one.
That's a good one. Okay, and then after that you played one of those on Philip Coran's record label, another little 7-inch, right?
That's right, it's the Spencer Jackson family. I think they're more of a gospel group out of Chicago, and they've done a couple of albums, couple of sevens. This one's on Zulu, Phil Curran's label, and I haven't done too much research into them. I'm sure some people have somewhere or other, but that's that heavy Afrocentric deep jazz stuff that they were doing in the late 60s, early 70s. That, you know, that's, you know, it's so incredibly intense, that type of music. That's exactly what I like. Brilliant, love it.
And you picked that up in Disc Union in Japan.
I did, yeah.
And they didn't realise it was worth, like...
Well, it was, you know, it was a few quid, but I was surprised to see it, because it's, you know, it's a rare record. I've never seen it before, and it was just there in the racks. Those sort of things usually change hands privately, you know, off the scene, so to speak. But to see it there, sat in the record shop, albeit amongst millions of other brilliant records as well, it's surprising. I was like, hand it over. That's coming home with me.
Hand it over in Japanese. Yeah. And the final 7-inch of the first little selection.
After that we heard Luke by the Light Men, which is on Judgment out of Texas. And again, he's I think that was Bubba Thomas' label in his band, and he's another one of those guys fiercely independent, made his own music, put his own records out. And I think Stone's Throw, or Now Again, are going to do a retrospective of him. I think they're working on it, and so hopefully, you know, that'll be out soon. But again, he's another guy who made a variety of records, never got any kind of success or proper achievement or recognition out of it, but he put his own records out there, and you know, they're a lot of good things as well, a lot of good stuff up by him.
Okay, we're going to get into some more little nuggets that you've brought with you, starting off with this one, right?
Yeah, this is Luis Xavier, and I'm not sure what side you've got on there, but it's a 7-inch from France called Synchro Rhythmic Eclectic Language. Thank you.
Yeah, we're back. We're back. So I'm really enjoying this because it's... People say, write to me and they go, Giles, we love it when you do a browser basement because we can just hear all that great stuff. We don't like it when you play all that fresh new stuff or hip-hop or whatever, dubstep. What are you doing that for? But so when I do the browser basements, people really like it. And this is you doing a browser basement for me, which I'm loving, because you're playing some utter gems. It's kind of upsetting me, because there's all this music that I know that I'm going to have to, at one stage, invest in, or... Well, just... But it's great. There's just so much... There's just so much music. I always keep thinking, we're going to run out, but then I come to you, or I go somewhere, and they play all these records. I'm like, oh, my God, all these tracks I can put on compilations.
Yeah, there's tons. There's tons of stuff out there, you know. It's...
it's all about digging, isn't it? You know, you've got to dig deep or you've got to look far and wide. But, you know, I mean, I'm lucky in the sense that this is my job and I can do it 7 days a week. I have been doing it 7 days a week for the last 20 years. And, you know, you build up a certain network of contacts over throughout the world. And when you think of it like that, there's people literally in every single country, all around the world, looking for records. And with the internet and everything, it just becomes a huge, big network of records changing hands and people get to know about things. And like we were chatting about earlier, every single country's got good music coming out of it in some way, shape or form. And there's been so much stuff, for instance, recently coming out of Africa. And back in the 90s, there was loads of stuff coming out of Brazil. And there's still stuff, you know, unknown stuff coming out of the States and every European country. There's private pressings that are discovered. There's a lot of sevens that people are turning their attentions to now because, you know, they might have dismissed them in the past because they were hard to look through, as opposed to something like LPs or something. And then you go into acetates and reel-to-reel tapes, and this goes on forever.
Acetates?
Yeah. I mean, look, for instance, you know, Northern Soul is still digging up acetates that, you know, one-offs and things, there's only a few copies, and they've been digging more intently than anyone for 30, 40 years. There's millions of records, millions of them, because in the past, people made a lot more records than they do now because they didn't have things like the internet or DVDs and things and computer games to get involved in. You know, most people spent their time, you know, with books and music, and as a result, thousands and thousands of people recorded records, you know, not just for the big labels, but small labels too. There's millions of them.
You've actually opened the door to me in a deep way today, just talking about the 7 inches, because just seeing some of the 7 inches that you're carrying with you, there's some stuff there which I think there's much more where that's all coming from, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. Especially ones that fall between the gaps, because in the past, say, rock collectors might have bought the rock or garage sevens, the Northern Soul collectors bought Northern ones, but the ones like, you know, some of the ones we've been playing, no one's really been looking for those or collecting them, quite simply because the category that they fall into isn't really something that people have been looking for in those collecting genres, so this has been overlooked and missed.
Tell me what those records were that you played, because there was that vocal track, but before that you played something that was...
We played something Turkish, which I'm not going to embarrass myself by trying to pronounce just a second
ago. That was the last track.
Yeah, before that we heard, I don't know where this is from, I know it's American, but it's a band called the Gingerbread Express. What style of music that is, I haven't a clue. It's jazz of some shape or form. It's not soul, it's not funk, it's not rock. So, you know, it's not going to found itself into the collecting categories of various people, so it just slips between the gaps. Before that, we heard a Canadian record by Sandy Shaw. Again, it's, you were saying, it's half Deirdre Wilson, half something else. I mean, you know, where do you categorise a record like that? And so, you know, they just never really get filed properly, and no one pays attention to them, and so they're just out there waiting to be discovered.
Let's play something else before we play a little thing which we'll talk about later, actually, which you're about to release, which is the trio track?
There's Lloyd Miller.
But we're going to play a 7-inch first, I think. Or should we play Lloyd Miller? No, let's play the 7-inch. We haven't got that long to go, I can't believe it.
Okay.
But I want to hear.
We'll cram it in.
The seven inches are just amazing. This is going to be one of the last ever podcasts that we're recording in Brownswood, but maybe not. I mean, I said that before, that it was gone, and it's not gone yet, but I think it's going to go, and I'm actually looking for somewhere to put all my stuff and start afresh with a new Brownswood type place. But I tell you what, you're finishing off amazingly well with some great tracks, Gerald. Thanks a lot for coming in today. We haven't really spoken enough about your label, which is the prime reason that you're here, because apart from anything else, you've been putting out some, you know, beautifully presented records, of whether it's the 7 inches or the collections of 7 inches that you've done in your series. I mean, you know, if you're a DJ going into sort of playing some sort of slightly more interesting music of sorts, then those CD comps are essential. I mean, I carry them everywhere. Welcome to the party, all that stuff. There's just nugget after nugget. So you just kind of compiled all your 7 inches and put them on CDs, right?
Yeah, pretty much so. Once we've got a certain amount together, it's good to put them on a CD, so, you know, people that don't have turntables can listen to them. There are people that don't have turntables, which I still don't understand why they haven't got one, but some people prefer that format. And yes, it means that you know, it's spreading the music further, isn't it? I remember at the time when I decided to put them on the CD, I had to be talked into it, because I was quite against them back in the olden days, being a vinyl person. But in terms of getting the music out there, which is the important thing, the artist is the person that makes the music. At the end of the day, it's them who wants the music to be heard by as many people as possible. So, it doesn't really matter about the format, as long as people get to hear it.
Yeah, the other thing is this thing. The way I look at it is that you get sort of you're finding yourself as a DJ playing in places, and sometimes the CDs sound better than the vinyls because they haven't got a vinyl set up properly. So it's nice to have the option, basically.
Yeah, this is true. Personally, I've never DJed a CD. I wouldn't have a clue on how it all works. I'm quite happy playing the sevens. But,
apart from the compilations and I mean, you're going to come back in. Let's do another one, right?
Okay, play more records.
This has been too good. But basically, for the right now, you've got this other series, haven't you, at the moment, where you're just re-releasing original albums like the Ricardo Moreira and...
Yeah, it's basically the same thing about as we did with the sevens. We started off doing the sevens mostly because they were cheap and easy. There wasn't a great deal of risk, and you know, there's not a great deal of money to play around with it in this business, because you know, it's minority music, and you're not going to sell a hell of a lot of copies, basically. So we didn't want to like risk the financial catastrophe if you put an album out with all the investment that it takes and it not doing very well. So but now we've got to the stage where we can do that, and they're doing really well. You know, we're choosing what we put out quite carefully to make sure that it fits the niche, and that it's worthy of release, because you know, there's a huge choice of albums that you can release, and we're just choosing to do the ones that we think are most worthy, so to speak. Yeah, and
the Holy Grail series,
that's right. Yeah, and the albums that everyone wants, that you can't really get because they're too rare for one reason or another, and we're just in the process of getting the John Hartsman album out.
Yeah.
And we've got more on the way as well. George Smallwood will come up next, and hopefully the Mortiam one a little while later, if we can, you know, pin him down, and you know, so on and so forth. So as long as people keep buying them, then we'll keep putting them out.
Gerald, we're going to leave a finish off of this from Lloyd Miller.
Mm-hmm.
Little something he recorded for you.
Yeah, it's he was over here a year ago, and we took the opportunity while he was here. He was in the studio. We had just a few hours. Literally just threw him in the studio with Malcolm Catto and Jake Ferguson from the Heliocentrics and said, right, try and make some music. I know you've never met each other before, but you're all good musicians. Just get it on and just see what happens. And they came up with some pretty impressive stuff. And this, I think, is one of the standout tracks. And no, it works. Lloyd Miller's phenomenal. You know, words can't describe the amount of talent he's got. He's like Roy Castle. He can play almost any instrument, probably play more instruments than him. But he's also phenomenally modest as well, which is why he's never really got any kind of kudos or recognition over the years, despite him being a professional musician for his 70 years. And so he went in there and he did the business. You know, have a listen.
That's too good. That is so, so good. That is Lloyd Miller with Heliocentrics and Malcolm Catto drumming along. And is that going to come out?
Yeah, we actually recorded it last November, I think. I just haven't got round to doing it. I've been busy doing other things, but I'm going to get my act together and stick it on a 12-inch put out early 2010, I hope.
Great feeling. Okay, let's. Well, we've extended a bit, but apart from doing these great compilations and reissues and selling me amazing records, you also do the odd contemporary thing, like this this band,
Natural Yogurt Band.
Band, who popped up a few years ago. I remember going crazy about it, and no one seemed to notice. And then and then it's just being picked up again by
Now Again. I've done it again.
They've just re-released it now, which is funny, right? After all that time. So this is some side project connected to it.
Yeah, basically, Natural Yoga Band were a couple of chaps. There's Miles and Wayne, and they basically make the music together with a lot of overdubs. And this is a kind of like a side project of Miles on his own, where that he's named The Sign of Four. And it's very much in the same keeping as Natural Yoga Band stuff. I just think it's phenomenal. I love it. It's one of them. Well, it's so intense, and those guys, they're having fun when they make that record, and that's what I think is missing out of a lot of music, that you can tell they're just having fun, and that's what music should be about, shouldn't it, really?
Well, it sounds wicked, and this is a new thing from you, from Jazzman. Thank you, Gerald.
Thank you, Giles.
We're going to do it again, right?
Yeah.
Part two. Course. Bring me some more music.
I'll bring some more.
More sevens.
Yeah.